busy sports night last night. And I was getting ready to do Leafs talk. So I'm primarily focused on the game. And if you listen to the show regularly, then you know I don't like to do a lot of channel flipping during a game. I'll just usually record and go back and then watch rather than the alternative. Baseball is a little different. I feel like you can get somewhat a sentiment of a baseball game from keeping it on a secondary screen experience. I don't need to be locked in as much. Probably why I love going to baseball games is so I can be chatty and then be like, oh, look, hit. Oh, big out. Oh, there's one. But in between, you can kind of relax. You can kind of chill out as a viewer. But yesterday, we had three games that I was really interested in going on at the same time. And we had the Elite Eight matchup between the Iowa Hawkeyes and the LSU Tigers, which absolutely delivered for Caden Clark. And I'll talk about that later on in the show. Because, yeah, I think that there are really, really, really big implications to Caitlin Clark, what she can be, and also what she's doing. The Leafs are winning, and then I'm like, oh, good. The Leafs are actually going to make it a little bit easier on me because they're running away with this hockey game, and the Panthers look like they're shutting down. So this might be a game where the final 10 minutes of the third period are basically like, put it on the second screen. If the Leafs go up 6-1, who cares? You're not going to really have to watch this. Both teams are just going to go into nothing matters mode. That didn't end up transpiring, and so I ended up having to pay closer attention to the Leafs game that I really wanted to. But either way, got the Jays game on, and they were the ones that made it easy on me. They were the ones that went, hey, we know you're busy. We know you're trying to channel flip. We know you really can only do two at once. So let us just give you the night off of the Toronto Blue Jays. Bowden Francis comes out and gets shell-shocked. Like, there's no other way to put it. I watched his start. I went back and rewatched it this morning. He left some horrific meatball pitches. That slider that he threw on the third home run that he gave up to make it 4-0 was one of the, like, I thought, if this is the way that you're going to pitch, if you're going to throw that ball, then the only thing you're going to be doing this year is pitching to Vladdy at the Derby. Like, that's where you're going to provide your value, sir, is the new pitcher at the All-Star game. Basically, everyone's going to choose you. Everyone's going to be like, groom me one of those sliders that you hang over the middle of the plate right in the heart of it. Bowden Francis, good job. Anyway, he's not the story here, okay? Like, he's the fifth starter. Alek Manoah is pitching a simulated game today, and ultimately, he's supposed to replace him. And I still think Bowden Francis is a good story, and if he's your number six pitcher, I think it's going to work out. Enough smart baseball people have told me what they think of this guy, and also even watching that game, despite him being flat out rattled, I thought that he had some moments anyways. Weird to say that. I understand it's weird to say that. He had some moments where I went, oh, okay, I'm seeing, that's, I get it. The stuff, he's got some nice stuff. He was nervous for his first big league start. He got tattooed. And then the Jays did him no favors by forcing him to go basically pitch nonstop for the first three innings because they were just three up, three down, three up, three down, three up, three down. Get back out there, Bowden. I'm not too concerned about him. The Jays' offense was the story last night. And again, for a normal team, you could say getting no hit, that's just going to happen. And congrats to this starter and blah, 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 right? This is not nearly as big a story if it happens to literally any other team in baseball. But the calculation that this front office made was, don't worry, we just need minor tweaks. We just need minor tweaks to run it all back. We saw a full season of these guys, and what we feel is it's fine. The offense is fine. It's going to be all positive regression. And again, there's a lot of baseball season to go, right? There's a ton. Sure. Could things be better? Could things be different? Duh. Of course. Of course. Ultimately, getting no hit shouldn't really mean anything. Except for this, to this team, it does. Because you have a fan base that was traumatized last year. You have a fan base that has had a horrific time watching this baseball team over the last season. And well, going back to the Mariners blown lead, that Mariners blown lead, which seemingly broke the brains of this front office because they shipped out a bunch of good guys and they went, we got to change the team and make them more mature. And then that didn't happen. But then they also removed the bats and they removed the passion. They removed the joy. They removed the heart of the team. So good job by Ross. That was a really swift and intelligent move by him to just complete, like, to not change a thing this year, but then to overreact the year before. Like, whatever. I guess I can never find a middle. But to get no hit 5 games into the season when everyone is terrified about what this offense is a horrific omen for this season. It's a horrific thing to put fans through right out of the gate. I've said it, and I said it to Shulman. People are guarded. They want to like this baseball team. People love the Toronto Blue Jays. This isn't like an overly cynical fan base. I'm sorry, it's not. In comparison to the Maple Leafs fans, who the second a puck goes in the net, like last night when they're defending a lead, it's like, oh my God, get ready for overtime. Oh, they're going to lose. The Leafs fan base, the psyche is completely shattered. If you're positive as a Leaf fan, you're viewed by, I would say, 80% of the fan base as a total rube. You're a sucker. That's not the Jays fan base. We've never been like this since like 2015. That was the whole beauty of 2015, is it kind of changed the attitude of the fan base from, hey, we're not just losers. That we can have good things happen to us. That was the beauty of the bat flip. Good things can happen to Blue Jays fans. And since 2015, that's been sort of the mentality, is compete and be good and do this. And all of a sudden, you're starting to see that cynicism creep in with everybody. And I don't blame you. I don't blame you for feeling that way. Because you did. You saw this team last year. And the idea that Isaiah Kiner-Falefa was going to come in here and materially change the offense was asinine. The idea that 40-year-old Justin Turner was going to look like Dodgers Justin Turner was kind of asinine. And they lost Bo Bichette, and you're going, oh, JD, they don't have Bo. Yeah, exactly. They missed one guy yesterday. One guy. And it felt like a completely hopeless, feeble offense. And that kind of stuff shakes you to your core. That kind of stuff makes you feel nervous. And so, yeah, Blue Jays, you still got time. You got an entire season. It's barely started. Everyone can look like an idiot who doubted this team, but, man, getting people to trust you, getting people to invest in you, getting people to really care about you and not feel that just underlying pessimism is going to be really difficult. And when you show up and you just go, yeah, Ofer, you get no hit by a fifth starter. Yeah, you better get ready for some overreactions. And to anybody who's telling people not to overreact, shut up. Let fans be fans. Okay. Seeing the early season preachy people come out of the woodwork to do the whole like, and it's just 5 games and it doesn't mean anything. And here's the way you should be feeling. Shut up. It's clearly different right now. And everybody with a brain knows it. Anyways, Leafs, I think 8 games left. 8 games left. Austin Matthews sitting at 62 goals. Did Leafs talk last night? Subscribe and review. James Myrtle, senior managing editor at The Athletic. What's up, brother? How are we doing?
Good. Yeah. I don't have any Jays angst, I got to tell you.
Yeah. I mean, do you care about any other sport other than curling? Like, that's your big thing, huh? Like, you sit down with the middle-aged ladies and you watch curling during the day. You got nothing going on. You're like my mom.
The Jays begin for me when the Stanley Cup is handed out, and then It's like, oh, it's time to watch some baseball now.
For me, the pain is that when the Jays season starts, I just want to get down to the ballpark so badly. Like, I love going to baseball games. I would say it's my favorite thing to do in the city. Like, nothing, every game, every sport, doesn't matter. Like, I guess if I had courtside tickets to the Raptors, I'd prefer that. I wouldn't prefer going to Leafs games. Having season tickets to the Leafs versus, I'd rather have season tickets to the Leafs because I would sell some. But going to baseball games, summertime, the beers, the friendship stuff, it's just the best. The way to watch it. And then hockey's just looming there. And then I start to like resent this part of the season because all I want to do is enjoy the early season excitement of baseball. But thankfully the Jays are starting on the road, so it's limiting the home games I'm going to miss. Anyway, this is where I want to start today. Did you watch Leafs talk last night?
I did. Okay, yeah, of course. I think I'm your number one fan.
That's so sweet. You're such a good friend, honestly. Yeah, you and Jackie Redmond, you're both great friends of mine who will text me about Leafs talk. Okay, so I have this Auston Matthews theory that I want to kick around with you and get your read on it, because people are going to start to sweat as he plays more and more games down the stretch of the season. But here's the reason why they're sweating, is because he's far and away the team's most important player. Like, it's without a shadow of a doubt. He's got 62 goals. And I know that that sounds obvious, but I don't know if, let's say, Florida fans, if they exist beyond, you know, 500 of them, are like really nervous about Barkov finishing the rest of the season, right? Like, if there's major conversations in Florida going, you know, they got to make sure Barkov is rested for the postseason, or if they're doing that in Tampa with Kucherov, or if they're doing that in Boston with Pasternak, I do feel like it is a bit of a Toronto-centric thing, but maybe part of that is who we are in terms of doom casting, who we are in terms of nervousness for the playoffs, who we are in terms of having had Kawhi Leonard in the city where load management becomes of even more import. But another part of it, I think, is, and sorry for going so long, but that we've seen Auston Matthews achieve incredible statistical heights. And even as he's doing this, we're a little numb to it. And like last night I went to bed, and this morning I woke up kind of thinking about it. As weird as it is to say, as much as every other hockey fan base would say I'm insane for saying this, I actually think he's underappreciated in this market.
I think that people have, yeah, I think people, it's become so automatic.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when they got Kessel, and Kessel would score 30 or 32, or, and it was 100%. A huge deal. Like, I was covering all those seasons, and it was, we did features about how he shot the puck and all this stuff. And, you know, Kessel's got 37 goals. I mean, Matthews has 37 goals by halfway through the season. Like, what he's doing is just, Matthews is one of the best goal scorers in the history of the game.
Yeah.
He just is. Like, I tweeted this yesterday before the game. He's 6 goals from having the most even strength goals in Leafs history. Now he's 5 because he scored another one yesterday. He's 5 goals from having the most even strength goals in franchise history for a franchise that's over 100 years old, and he's 26 years old.
Yep.
That doesn't make any sense. It seems impossible.
So I think he's now, what, 60 off of Sundin all time too?
Yep.
Okay. So
yeah, he can get there next year. Like, easily.
Yeah. Oh, easily. Without a doubt. Okay. So, and even Alex Ovechkin didn't have 2 60 goal seasons, which is crazy to think about. But Matthews already has that done. He's already accomplished something that Alex Ovechkin, the person who everyone tells me is the greatest goal scorer of all time, and it's not up for debate, and so I'm not allowed to weigh in on that debate. That's already signed, sealed, delivered. It's done. Who cares? Era adjustment, all the different stuff. But that Matthews has already accomplished this twice. I think that there's 2 other things at play here, too, with the non-Matthews credit that he gets. One is that he's in the same era as Connor McDavid, who creates his offense in a more spectacular fashion, right? Like, Matthews versus McDavid, when you're watching the two of them, Matthews, when you're trying to compare, it's not really a comparison, right? It just isn't. Even though Matthews is brilliant, McDavid is just a whole other entity. And the way McDavid can create in transition and just blow by people and make everyone look silly is just more aesthetically pleasing. We're like, oh, we get this. You're creating this. You're driving all of this. Matthews is at Marner. Matthews is a finisher, a pure finisher, who's elite defensively, does all this stuff. But when we're looking at the two, I feel like we diminish Matthews because he doesn't create the offense in the same way as his, you know, contemporary. And 2 is that stuff that you're talking about, where he's 6 even strength goals off of being the franchise leader. I genuinely think that there is like an understated resentment to Matthews for that. That like, he's not celebrated in the same way as those greats because he hasn't done it in the postseason. You know, like, people are reluctant to be like, damn, he's having one of the best seasons of all time. Damn, he's having one of the greatest statistical years, because they don't want him to be ahead of some of those other guys. Like, they don't want him to jump Matt Sundin when he's won 1 playoff series and hasn't been the same producer in the postseason. They don't want him to jump the mythology of Sittler and Gilmore. You know what I mean? Like, there's part of it is,
I don't know if he can, right? Like, I think he needs a run. You know, they need 3-4 rounds at least once. You know, like, the Sundin teams, they didn't win at all, but they they put it all on the line and went deep a few times. And, you know, there's a whole generation of the fan base that looks back so fondly on those years, you know, 02, 03, that this group doesn't have, like, this group right now is just known as underachievers. You know, they're almost historically underachieving. You know, the number of teams that have gone out in the first round this many times in a row, and I know they won a round last year, but the number of times a team this good has disappointed this many times in a row, I mean, they're right up there with some of the most historically disappointing teams. You know, they're talked about in the same vein as those Ovechkin Capitals teams that, I mean, Ovechkin didn't win. I think, was he 33 when he won? You know, it was a long, long road of disappointment, and he played with a lot of different players. And, you know, if Washington had never broken through, that's all anyone would talk about with Ovechkin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I completely agree. Even the San Jose Sharks teams that always fell flat, at least they won multiple playoff rounds, right? At least they
went to the final. Yeah. You know, they
were in a cup. They lost to Sidney Crosby and they ran out of gas. Like they at least had some moments. The Leafs have yet to have that. So you understand what I'm saying here, because I'm kind of searching for it, but yeah, there is like a feeling, I think, underlying feeling from I would say it's probably older fans. I'm not as connected to the Gen Z group or younger Leaf fans that aren't tied to kind of the history of the franchise as much. I know I would certainly, if I didn't have the trauma of being a Leafs fan for, you know, 3 decades, that I would probably feel differently about it too. But it's almost like, hey, you're getting all these things, you're having all these accomplishments, but without the stuff that matters the most. And so the older fans are kind of like, yeah, sure, great. But when you watch it, it's like, no, it really is. It's unbelievable what we're seeing here. And I don't think that we appreciate it enough. I just don't know how you can check into that mentality when the other stuff is hanging over it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess the only way you can is if you're confident that at some point there's going to be a breakthrough. But I think, you know, what you're talking about off the top about the psyche of Leafs fans, like there's not a lot of confidence. And I see it on social media every single game, because I'm always posting stuff about, you know, Matthews is doing this thing that's never been done before, or he's the first player since Lemieux to do X, Y, Z. And the replies, the reply guys are often, you know, and I don't want to be ageist, but, you know, you get Leafs fans who are my age or older, and they're saying, yeah, but what about the playoffs? Mm-hmm. And they're saying that all season. They're saying that in October. They're saying it now, you know, and that's one of the hard things for this group, is that the only thing that matters is what happens in April.
Yeah. No, I think that's actually the fan base age divide, is that if you're a younger fan, you're like, this is unbelievable. We can't believe we have this guy. We've just been kind of unlucky. And if you're an older fan, you're like, God, these guys love the cookies in the regular season and they accomplish a lot, and who cares, because they've never done it when the hockey gets harder. And so you get that reaction to the Matthews stuff. I will tell you this. I'm being very honest. I am a huge Austin Matthews fan. I get a lot of joy out of his goal scoring. He is already one of my favorite Maple Leafs of all time. But even when you say that stuff, like when you go, he's 5 even strength goals off of it, when he's 60 away, where he's going to pass Matt Sundin, and what? Matthews is what now, 26?
Yeah.
So in his age 27 season, he's going to pass Matt Sundin. Something about it makes me not feel great. You know, like something about it makes me go like, oh, I kind of hope he doesn't. Like, I hope he gets 59 goals next year, you know? Like, I it's a weird thing. It's a very, very strange thing. And I think it takes away from his greatness and his brilliance. And just like last night, I'm watching him, and even that empty net goal that he makes, it's like, he's the one that breaks up the play. He makes a beautiful play with his stick. He's an awesome defensive player, and he just rips it down the ice. And my brain went to, like, automatically, oh, there's another empty netter for him. That's good. He's getting closer to 70. It's like, no, that was a spectacular play. He is a spectacular player. His line is dominating. Max Domi, we spend so much time talking about, like, Max Domi's turned it around. Max Domi's first. It's like he plays with Austin Matthews. Tyler Bertuzzi has turned it around. He's done so much better. It's like he's playing with Austin Matthews more. That's the connector here. This guy is not getting any credit for elevating those around him. He doesn't get as nearly enough credit for how good he is defensively, how much he dominates 5-on-5, how great he is with his stick. I saw Mike Kelly tweeted this yesterday. Hold on, let me pull it up. He won 9 puck battles, and I do think the puck battle stat is a little, you know, subjective.
He's so good with his stick. It's incredible what he can do.
That's what I mean.
He uses it like a pool cue or something, and he's tapping guys and, you know, I don't even know what he's doing half the time. It's amazing how he creates turnovers.
He's sixth in the league with 223 puck battles won this season. Again, take that stat with a grain of salt, but I do think that it's indicative of how good he is at breaking up plays, stealing pucks, and winning them. And just because he's not a huge physical player where he's bowling people over all the time, I don't think, again, he gets credit for that. He is just an unbelievable player. And
well, he could win the Selke. Yeah. I mean, when has there been a guy who's the top goal scorer? I think he's 10 ahead of the next best goal scorer and win the Selke. Like, I don't think that's ever happened.
Yeah.
There's not really a parallel for him. Like, who do you even compare to historically? Who's been a Selke level center who could score goals like Ovechkin? Like, Ovechkin is a one-way machine.
Well, yeah. But
that's not what Matthews is at all.
Yeah, no one is that. I would say that, like, Datsyuk was an elite offensive player, like, as dangerous as they come, who was also the top of the top when it came to defensive hockey. So I would say, like, the closest thing to him is Datsyuk, right? Like, in the modern...
Well, I think it's more like Mario or something, or, I don't know, maybe Joe Sakic, or I'm trying to think, like, a guy with a shot who can just create goals. Matthews is his own thing, and if they had any playoff success, you know, if they had been to the second round two or three times and been to the third round once, I think you're right. I think he would be talked about a lot differently in the city.
Yeah.
And he still is beloved. Like, you walk around the streets in my neighborhood, and all, you know, all the kids have Matthews jerseys, and, like, he's... You know, he's a legend, but, you know, he signed that 4-year extension, and, like, this is the window, because if it falls apart or the team's not competitive, I don't know. And again, like, you know, I don't know. I don't know if he's going to be a lifetime Leaf. I mean, obviously they should try and make that happen, but if they can't get over the hump here, like, this, these next 3-4 years, he needs to, the whole group needs to break through.
No, I think that's totally it. Is the thing that's going to determine whether he's a lifelong Leaf or not is whether he wins. I think that if they continue to struggle and have brutal outs in the postseason, it's just not going to be fun to be a Leafs fan. And eventually he is going to say, why am I here? I can make more money elsewhere because of taxation. I can live down in the States and get more adulation from a U.S. fan base that doesn't really care or know about me. And
like, it's going to be hard to keep the window open for like another 6 or 7 years, right? Like, you know, you trade your picks, like, at some point, you know, like, kudos to Tampa for keeping it going this year. But, you know, lots of teams end up like, you know, Chicago and San Jose, where you just can't do it forever. So, you know, it's not like it would be very unusual if the Leafs can keep the contention window open Matthew's entire career and he stays here.
Anyway,
but maybe they can, but it's going to be hard.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't want to sound like I'm trying to split the atom here, or that this is some extremely nuanced take, but I think that he probably suffers the most out of any athlete that I can remember in this city from carrying the ghosts of the Leafs past. And again, he owns some of that blame because he hasn't performed in game sevens, right? He did go stretches like in that Florida series where he didn't score goals, or in the Montreal series where it felt like he was snake bit and shied away from it as well, where he gets shut down by Desharnais and you go, this shouldn't happen. You're supposed to elevate and dominate at this point. But like you said, Mats Sundin never won Stanley Cups. Yes, he made playoff runs, but who cares? You know, like, when did that become the marker? It's always been, it's 1967. It was never 2003, which was like the playoff series win one, right? No one ever chanted that at people. It's 67 because you're there to win Stanley Cups. And all of these other guys that get shoved in a Leafs lore this way by every fan of every ilk, Matthews is the first guy where it's like, no, this is genuinely the best Toronto Maple Leaf ever, without a shadow of a doubt. Like, no questions, no ifs, ands, buts about it. Even without the playoff success, he is the most talented guy. Maybe you can't say the best because, yeah, generational, whatever, and guys won cups, but man, Matthews, just the lack of just pure love that he gets from, I think, guys that are close-ish to my age and older, is a little bit insane. It really is. It's a little bit insane. And I think that, yeah, that kind of needs to stop. It's got to be a little bit more of unbelievable respect, a little bit more to one of the game's, greatest players of his generation. Okay, so you heard my theory on Matthews. I brought it up on the show, so I'm not going to go long with it. But where are you at in terms of the chase for 70 and the belief that this is actually a really important thing for this Leafs team in terms of not checking out down the stretch, staying engaged and having something to play for in otherwise, well, I don't want to say meaningless games because they are chasing Florida, but more so meaningless games.
I know. I think for Matthews, getting more than 65 matters because it's going to be more than Ovechkin's ever had.
Yeah.
And it's going to be something no one has done since Lemieux had 69 back in 96. I think that matters to him. So I think that there's, I don't think 70 is the only thing that's going to matter. I think getting to 66 is going to matter. So it's kind of like going to go in stages here, right? They've got a back-to-back against Tampa and Florida in the year. So I think if he's at 65, I think he's going to play both those games because he's going to want to get to 66. But if he's at 66 or 67 and it's unlikely he can get to 70, maybe he does rest one of those games. Mm. I mean, I think all you're talking about is, does he miss one game? Like, I don't think they're going to sit him for multiple games. Do they dial back his ice time a little bit in some of these games? But on the flip side to what you're talking to, I think if you're Sheldon Keefe, you use this yeah. as a way to say these games mean something and let's play with some emotion and let's play like we care about each other. Let's play like we want to do this for Matthews. We want to help him get to, you know, he's doing something really historic right now. Let's get behind that as a team. And I think they're doing that. You know, I think that I think everybody in that room is thinking about and talking about, and I mean, the media is going in the room and talking to them about it everywhere they go.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're getting behind that. And Matthews is a quiet guy, but he's a leader in that dressing room. And he has tons and tons of respect and tons of friends in that dressing room. And, you know, so I think it makes sense to use it as kind of a rallying point. It's not to say that, you know, that the playoffs aren't what really matters, but I think what Sheldon Keefe wants to do is the stuff we were talking about last week. He wants to make this matter and keep them engaged and keep them ready, as opposed to just sleepwalking into the playoffs and trying to flip a switch, which they've tried to do in the past and it's burned them.
Mm-hmm. What do you, I think Keefe did a really good job burning that bullet a week ago, where he had, what was the quote exactly? It was that the leaders weren't mature. It was a very immature hockey game that they played.
Against Jersey. Yeah.
Yeah. And it seemed, the team seems to have responded since then. Again, like they kind of went to sleep in the third period yesterday, but they still got out of there with a win and they were really good. Their starts have been better. A lot of things are clicking for them despite being down some defensemen and a couple of really important forwards. Like, yeah, they're down five important pieces in that game against the Panthers, and they totally outclassed them through the first two periods. He had some stuff yesterday, though, where he's playing some of the young guys in big spots, or he was playing mm-hmm. even Ryan Reeves in big spots. And afterwards, mm-hmm. he talked about it and said that that's kind of development. Do you like him using this time as development? Like, do you
I do.
Like him
I mean, you're
doing
up
that
five.
Stuff?
Yeah, you're up 5-1, right? I think he needs to know, like, can he go into the playoffs with a kid line like that and have to play them in mm-hmm. moments? Like, that's because you're not going to be able to shelter that line when you're on the road in the playoffs against a Boston or a Florida. So what can they give him? Like, obviously they're not going to be as defensively sound as Matthews or Kampf or Tavares, but can you play them? You know, they didn't play a lot. You know, everyone's talking about that the kid line is the third line. They were the fourth line last night.
Mm-hmm.
Like they played like 8 minutes together or something. So I think what Keefe's trying to see is, like, can he trust them in 8 minutes? Can he play Robertson, Nyes, Holmberg? You know, and you've got guys coming back, and Marner's coming back soon this week.
Think he's back
tomorrow?
When
you're. I think so, but mm-hmm. it'll depend. I mean, we'll see if he's on the ice for practice today. They're practicing, I think, at noon. I don't know if Yarncross can be back or not, but let's say they both come back. You're going to have some tough decisions on who comes out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want to sit, you're not going to take McMahon out. I like the way that Dewar's played. You know, if they're playing Florida, and probably if they're playing Boston too, with the way he's played, I think Reeves probably is in the playoff lineup, right? So all of a sudden you're looking at, like, who are you taking out? It's going to be a tough call. And I think that that's part of what Keefe wants to see, is you play him in tough situations against good players, and who plays well and who buckles and who makes mistakes. Mm-hmm. And we saw some of that last night.
Who are you taking out? Starts tomorrow.
if there's two, I mean, you know me, like I think I would take Reeves out, but I mean, he's playing well. So,
uh-huh.
I think I take Robertson out, which is a harder case to make after he, you know, creates the offense he did yesterday. I'm just worried about him giving it back the other way. I think Robertson and Reeves is probably who I would take out.
Okay.
Now, I haven't done the, like, what are all the lines in my head yet, but, yeah. You know, that's going to be part of it.
No, yeah, and we'll end up doing that. But, yeah, I think you're right in terms of the first two guys that are out are those two guys. The question is it going to be two guys? Because it's been quiet on the Yarncroc front.
Yeah, I don't know. And he's had multiple injuries, I think, to the same hand. So, you know, it's not like it's just one thing that's taken him out.
Yeah.
He might be a guy that's not ready. And again, I don't know for sure. The Leafs have been really tight-lipped about injuries lately, which I think is what that Marner quote was from on the weekend about people guessing what his injury was. You know, it could be a situation where Yarncroc doesn't come in until game two, game three, game four, and, you know, it's only one player coming out. And in that case, I think it would probably be Robertson. But it's certainly going to be a conversation with the front office. And who knows? There's still eight games. I mean, there still could be someone else who gets hurt here. So, you know, we'll see.
Here's what I would say. If it's just down to one and it's between Robertson and Reeves, I don't really think it matters. I don't think that either guy is, like, they're both such heavily flawed players that you can make a pretty strong argument for either one being out. I think Reeves is probably the guy I would leave in between the two, just because I love when he's doing, like, he starts that game yesterday with a huge hit, and then what ends up happening? Lomberg takes a penalty right after. Like, they start to lose their mind, and the other team starts scrambling and running around and trying to impose their physical identity. Like, having him out there does matter. The thing that scares me a bit with Reeves is not only the foot speed and him getting trapped in his own end, that stuff, but it's that there are times, and maybe it's just regular season stuff, and he tightens that up come postseason, but there's been times this year where it gets later in the game, and then he starts to kind of, like, run around and want to impose that, and you go, don't do that anymore. Like, they don't need that in this point of the game. They just need you to lock down and not take stupid penalties, and he sort of got away with one yesterday, and that scares me a bit, is the Kyle Clifford-itis.
Yeah.
The, I got to do something, and I got to make this happen. I got to force it. If you could eliminate that, I think Reeves is a kind of clearly ahead of Robertson right now. But the other thing is, with Robertson, what he showcased yesterday is, man, like, this team has just not had anybody who could break a game in the postseason year over year over year. And it's the thing that I think some people keep missing when they talk about the team around Matthews is all of a sudden there are dudes who can finish. And you stack enough of those guys up and you start to see pucks go in the net, and maybe things break differently from the Leafs, just from obviously a practical standpoint, but a psychological standpoint of no more losing games 1-0 or 2-1.
Well, they're the highest scoring team in the league since January 1. You know, they're averaging over four goals a game the last 2 months. So this, like, they've been on fire, and it's not just Matthews and Nylander. You know, Matthews and Nylander were carrying the offense for the first 3 months of the season. Now it's everybody's been filling the net. And I think, you know, that's definitely been something that's been lacking in the playoffs. So, yeah, I mean, I like the idea of – that's the thing with that I keep calling them the kid line, which probably makes me seem old. But, you know, like having the young guys play together and being able to put some in – having Bobby McMahon able to move him up the lineup and he's scoring, all of a sudden Domi and Bertuzzi are scoring. Kampf, you know, is looking like he's got a little bit more offense lately. That's what they need. They're going to need some of those greasy goals from down the lineup. And there have been some postseasons where you look at it and remember last year, like I think like the whole bottom six, they got nothing. Like there was,
you know, year over year they had that.
They like there's the third and fourth line, just, you know, the Engvalls and Mikheyev and Kerfoot and, you know, guys like even like Achari, I think had two goals in, what did they play? 12, 13 playoff games last year. Like they've had a lot of bottom six guys that have produced nothing in the playoffs. They need one of those guys in a playoff series. They need a McMahon to get four goals or something like that. Like they need the by the committee. And, you know, for the last 2-3 months of the season, it looks like they've got enough firepower there that they can do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, two more things. One, how do you feel about the goaltending job or the goaltending battle right now? Because I thought after the Buffalo game, I came out here yesterday and went, you know what? This is Samsonov's job now. He's done the better job. He looks good. Let him run with six of the final nine games. And then yesterday, as they were sort of melting down, I went,
I don't think it's decided yet.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think it's not over. Wall's probably going to start tomorrow, right? So
that's what I thought now too, after that game. I went, yeah, maybe he's put Wall in against Tampa, but when do you have to decide though? Because
fighting with yourself here.
Yeah. But I don't think that they should wait until the final, you know, I don't think that it should be a question leading into game one. I really don't believe that's good.
Well, dial it in the last four games of the season, right? Like give one guy three of the last four.
Yeah. So then
unless Samsonov starts dominating more games. I know he's had some dominant performances, but last night wasn't it. I'm not ready to for sure say it's not Wool for game one. So I play him tomorrow against Tampa.
Yeah, I regret saying it was over after the Buffalo game. I went, it's over. But it was a spectacular performance. Like I didn't get to watch it live. I went and watched it without any emotion attached to it. I wasn't on Twitter that night. I was out. I woke up the next Sunday morning and I rolled the tape and I watched it and I was like, I hadn't read a story. I had no idea what was going on. And I went, man, this guy was the story of the game. Like I'm sure Matthews hitting 60 was everything. And obviously the crowd was spectacular, but he was unbelievable. And then even I went back and, you know, I watched the post game stuff and the way he was carrying himself to the media and just kind of feeling himself, the way he was speaking, I went, man, this guy's back to, remember when we were getting cute quotes from Samsonov last year and it was fun and he was not afraid to put himself out there from a non-vulnerable personality standpoint. I went, oh, he's returned to this now. He's back. And then, yesterday when they were kind of skittish against Florida, I went, oh, God, you still make me nervous. Maybe, but I just don't know if that will ever go away with him now because of what he did to start the season.
I feel like it's probably Samsonov, though, right? Like
it's probably
60-40 or, 70-30 or something like that, Samsonov. But I don't think the battle is quite over yet.
Yeah, I declared it. I called it, and now it's like, oh, we need a recount, and I look like an idiot. I called the election too early.
You know what, though? I think that if you're gonna make a switch in a series, I think
that's
going
fine.
To Wool second probably makes more sense, right? We've seen him do that, and he's going to be ready to do it. So, you know, that's part of why I would lean towards it being Samsonov for game one.
It was part of my argument for this all along. Anyway, I already feel proven correct on this, which I'm happy. I don't always root for the take, but it's not bad when you get it. I said right away this was going to be a goaltending battle, and everyone told me I was an idiot. I was like, okay. And it has been, and it's going to be a goaltending battle down the stretch. And, yeah, it's 60-40 still, but, yeah, it feels like it's Samsonov 64. I'd give Samsonov more of an edge than that. I just think, like, Wool would have to play spectacular Wednesday night and force their hand to play in the Montreal game and then just continue. I think Wool now has less margin for error than Samsonov does, if that makes sense.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay, last one, because I haven't spoken to you since they locked up Benoit.
He was very good last night.
He really was.
He was one of their best players last night.
100%. Yep. No question about it. What do you think of that deal? Because most people just go, well, it's great because it's cheap and you got a guy tied up. But was it necessary? Like, was he going to get that much more? Like, what is your read on this deal? Because you're a very good cap guy, contract guy. And, I don't know. I thought it was kind of hard to push back on. But then I saw some people and I was texting with some people who were like, yeah, I don't really like it. And I was like, okay. I was like, why rush to this? I was like, it's fine.
You get the years, right? Like, you get the 3 years, you know? Like, I'm pretty sure it's two RFA years and one UFA year. I mean, if he keeps playing like this, him in 2 years, I got it right, right? It was 3 years, 1.35 was the contract, right?
Yeah. 3 years.
You buy a UFA year for like nothing. The cap's in 3 years, the cap's going to be pushing $100 million. And even if he's a third pair guy making 1.3, you bought a UFA year. Like if he plays like this, he could play 18 to 20 minutes and he goes to UFA, a big physical defenseman like him, he's getting what? $3-4 million? I mean, look what guys like Radko Gudas and these like third pair guys that are, you know, defensive players get. So you're making a bet that he's going to be a huge home run for you in years two and three of that contract. He's not a very old guy. I think he's 25. Mm. That's why he's still an RFA. And it just looks baffling that Anaheim walked away from the guy. Because I think worst case scenario for him is that he's your number six defenseman. Uh-huh. And for 1.35, that's fine. I mean, I guess the very worst case scenario is he's less than that. But even if you have to waive him, you know, that cap charge is almost disappears. Yeah. Almost none of it will be, like, there's very little downside to me. And I honestly, I'm not really sure from his perspective why he signed for so long.
That was my follow-up question is like, I don't, it seems
the
to me.
The term is why it's a win for the Leafs.
Sure.
Because it could end up being like, look at the Joseph Woll contract. Mm. They gave him 3 years. He's making $780,000, I think. He's making nothing.
Yeah.
And then he might be their starter next year.
Yeah.
So that's what you're betting on with those kind of contracts.
Yeah. It's especially tough looking at Wolves because he's older and he signed that deal and I don't know, now feels like he's going to be in a tough spot to ever really get paid in his career. You know what I mean? Like, he'll make millions of dollars, but yeah, you look at his age and the contracts and the time and the position, like, kind of squint and say, you might have shot yourself in the foot with that. I don't get the reason why Benoit would take the 3 years. I think it's a big win for the Leafs. Like, I just, for the reasons you just said, is I don't see, there's zero potential for a massive backfire here. Like, there's no implication that's what I mean. There's no implication to it going wrong. And I just don't understand why he wouldn't have walked it later and said, even if I don't play in the postseason, you can't teach my size. I've clearly looked good. I've played up and down the lineup and I'm a physical freak who's still young. I'll be fine. I'll end up getting more money than this. Like, the third year was a little strange. I guess maybe he really likes it here.
That's what I was going to say. You know what it is? He wants to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's possible now with that contract. That's a discount for sure.
Yeah.
So it's a really good contract for Trey Living. It really is because, you know, a lot of agents and I haven't talked to his agent about this, so I don't know what their thinking was, but a lot of agents would be like, hey, just like, you know, go to arbitration, grind out a 1 year deal, you know, get to UFA because there's going to be a big number there for you.
Yeah.
You know, look at the contracts that like Goodbranson and like, there's so many guys that are like him around the league that have made a lot of money to be kind of what he is. And I think that he loves it here, but also that, you know, the development staff has worked with him a lot and they see upside in this guy. And if they can get his skating up a little bit and his puck handling up a little bit, look at the reinvention to his game that Luke Shen went through the last couple of years, get Benoit working with some skills coaches on being able to have a better first pass and a little bit better stick handling. And you might really have something with him.
Yeah. I love the deal. And I think Tree Living deserves a lot of credit for this, but here's the part that I haven't mentioned yet. I also really love this because rewarding McMahon and Benoit with contracts before the playoffs start, it's great vibes for the team. Guys are thrilled to see those guys get paid. Guys are thrilled to know that those guys are part of the team. You're removing some of the mercenary element with this group, you know? Some of the financial, I don't want to say insecurity because that's a little generous, but, you know, the feelings of maybe I'm not here this year. It's no, you're a team. You guys can be around. You're a part of this. I like it. I just think that from a chemistry standpoint, Tree played this extremely well. And I think from a like practicality and value standpoint, he nailed it too. So good job by the Leafs on these ones. James, thanks for making time, brother. We'll talk to you next week.
Yeah. Thanks, JD.
See you, pal. James Riddle, Senior Managing Editor at The Athletic. I also just want to say too, with the Matthews stuff, and maybe this is me just fleshing out. I don't know. Maybe I'm off on this. But yeah, no, it is just so spectacular. And my entire life as a Leaf fan, I just would have killed for this. And I know some of it is just being younger and, you know, you look up to players when you're young, like they're your boyhood heroes. And now when you do it professionally, you don't idolize people the same way. So there's definitely an element of that. And I think that also when you just get older, that happens too, is, you know, your boyhood heroes stay that way. And so maybe part of it is just like the feeling of awkwardness that he's going to rip past Matt Sundin that quickly. Like, that he's going to dwarf Matt Sundin's stats as a Leaf. But yeah, I do think that the lack of playoff success has hampered our ability to actually appreciate him properly, which is probably true about all traumatic fan bases and a lot of people who have watched their team struggle, and lose. But no, he's suffered from it the most. And yeah, just like literally sounds so lame as a as a guy in his 30s to be going to bed being like thinking about Matthews doesn't, I don't appreciate him enough. that's how I go to sleep at night, is thinking about things like this. Anyway, also I want to point it out too, is that not discussed with Matthews, the power play was 4 of 44 in March, and it's struggling against, got no Mitch Marner, and Matthews still has, what is it? I think 15 power play goals this year. Let me look it up quick. Yeah, he's got 15 power play goals this year. Leon Draisaitl has 19 on 39 goals. He had 32, Leon Draisaitl, the year before that. Matthews, the year before that, 13. These are two guys that get compared to one another. And as pissed off as Oilers fans get when they compare, when we compare McDavid to Matthews, Leafs fans should be equally as pissed when they compare Draisaitl to Matthews. This is like, no. No. Anyways, quick break and let's talk about Caitlin Clark.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So first of all, you're welcome for giving everybody the Caitlin Clark over. Last night was some of the easiest money I've ever made. Tweeted it out, put it on my Instagram, follow there for bets. I thank God for that, because the men's Elite Eight, I got murdered. Murdered. It was, I don't think I picked the game right. I think I was off on every single one. Every time, it was like Sweet 16 to Late Eight. I bet against them. All of a sudden, the players on the other team look the best. I go, well, they're great. Like Duke, like, wow, Filipowski kid is better than I thought. Then I bet on him against NC State. And it's like, Filipowski, 2 points, no rebounds at the half. Like, nice. But Caitlin Clark delivered. And that was a really special night. I loved it so much, because when you have a game like that, a legacy game, and you show up and you deliver, that's what sports are all about. That's what this is all for. When everything is made up about you and the entire world is going, Caitlin Clark, Caitlin Clark, Caitlin Clark, what are you going to do? How's she going to get a revenge? Is she going to be able to get a revenge? Can she show up in this game? Will she show up in this game? And people have been waiting a year for it, and then you have that type of performance. I think it goes down as, yeah, like, I'm not being hyperbolic here. It's one of the more impressive performances that I can remember, if not the most. It's like Kemba Walker in college sports for me. Anthony Davis with Kentucky. And this, like, this is unbelievable. The pressure that she was under to show up and just dominate that way. That poor Van Lith girl who tried to defend her the entire night was like, it was a nightmare. I was watching that for her, and I started, that's when you know it's bad, is when you start to feel like, oh my God, that other girl is, you know, she's just a college athlete. This isn't the pro, like, this is going to haunt her for the rest of her life. Like, there's nothing she can do. Someone else go out there and defend her. 10 threes. For context, that's only been done a few times in NBA history where people have hit 9 threes. For context, Synergy Basketball, an analytics site, Caitlin Clark created, assisted, or scored 73 of Iowa's points in that win. That was dominance. We've never seen a women's player score off the dribble from behind the three-point line like Caitlin Clark. We already knew that, but to do that in that huge game where it's just unstoppable was incredible. The way that she can just kind of like step side to side, falling away, hit threes. She's attempting threes from like, you know, 8 feet behind the three-point line in this thing. The confidence that she has in the stroke, the ability, it's so far and away from everything that we've seen from women's basketball before. And so to me, it's like that moment and really the rest of her career, hopefully, I think that she's going to be the Steph Curry of basketball, not the three-point shooting, like she's going to change women's basketball materially. We are going to have conversations of who among women's athletes were the most impactful ever. I think one, in terms of breaking through to men, like, she's number one in all of sports right now, without a shadow of a doubt to me. Like, she is far and away the women's athlete that more men are completely invested in, that are like, yep, I want to watch her play. I want to see what she's doing right now. Like, I don't know a lot of guys that are real sports fans, that are real hoops fans, that actually aren't excited to watch her now in the Final Four and in the finals. Like, I think most guys I know are going to watch it. But for young girls, I'm fascinated to see what her impact is on the game. If we're going to see, if she's a one of one supernova, and we just, like, there's so much inherent talent, so much work that we can't see it, or if this is the beginning of something completely different, and all of a sudden we start seeing, like, Caitlin Clark after Caitlin Clark after Caitlin Clark. Because, like, we've always seen physically dominant women, like, Angel, more of the Angel Reese mold, right? Where it's like, oh, they're bigger, they're stronger, they've got touch around the basket. I'm not trying to discredit this player, but it's easier to understand when you're dominating a basketball game that way, where it's your size and your touch inside. It's harder to look at it when you're like, this... So follow a three for your 8-3 of the game. This is just like an impossible cover and transition. I've never seen anybody in the women's sport that was as unguardable as Caitlin Clark, and nobody has. Unbelievable performance. And just to do it in the clutch like that, incredible. Can't wait for the rest of the run. Anyways, quick break. Let's talk to Bobby Marks. March always delivers. Now we have two tournaments too, which is great. Like that you actually pay attention to with, Caitlin Clark again, the dominant performance from yesterday, but... I haven't really been able to get a good grasp of what March has done for some of the prospects that we're going to see in the draft this year. Obviously, everybody knows now in this market that the Raptors have picks. They're tanking games in spectacular fashion. What are they up to now? 13 losses in a row? I don't know, because it's impossible to watch the Raptors. Like I said, I went to that Oklahoma City game to watch Shea, and I haven't really tuned in for more than 5 minutes since. But yeah, it's a very, very strange draft where it's one that's been talked down on. And I want to know if there's been any risers. Bobby Marks, our guy, ESPN front office insider, former Nets assistant GM. What's up, man? How are we doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I got to ask you first, like, what were your thoughts on last night's game? Because, yeah, that is one of my favorite things to watch in any sport, is when someone that has all the hype, all the pressure on their shoulders, delivers in spectacular fashion. And yeah, it was breathtaking last night what we saw from Caitlin Clark.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think that the women's product is much better than the men's. I think you can make a strong argument. I think it's more captivating. I think it's better. I think it's a better product in general last night. And I think last night's, you know, LSU-Iowa game, I mean, it was a Final Four level game, and the expectation, especially on her shoulders, she came out and delivered. I mean, you could say the same thing with the UConn-USC game right after. I mean, there were some big time shots, and I thought it was awesome. I mean, I think there was a Sunday back in early March where I caught myself watching, the conference finals like for 4 hours, you know? And I think the big reason why the women's product is better is because these girls are there for 3 years.
Yeah.
They're there for 4 years. There's a familiarity. I mean, that Iowa starting lineup is basically all seniors, except for one and everything. So, probably a little bit less transfer portal. But I thought she was awesome last night. Just the shot making. I mean, that was the shot making and the ability, to find her teammates. You know, her assist total probably doesn't get talked as much as her scoring has.
Yeah, no, the assists were also brilliant. It's like, again, she's completely uncoverable from back there. We've never seen a women's player who, can score off the dribble from the three-point line the way that she does. She obviously thinks the game at an extremely high level. I like what you said there, though, about the product in terms of, yesterday there felt like there was just, like, crazy stakes, right? And I haven't felt that in the men's tournament outside of just the natural, you're playing for a championship, right? Like, you're playing for the title. But in terms of rivalries or, personal stakes for players, it's like, it's all right. Like, felt a little bit that with Edie and Purdue, especially early on, because they choked the year before and he came back. But he also came back because it was, like, necessary, right? Like, he had to come back. There was really no path for him in the NBA this season. I haven't really felt the stakes as much of them in the men's game. I'm curious, though, if, you have a lot of conversations with a lot of high-level people. Yeah. Do you think that they're, like, with this transfer portal stuff and the NIL deals and all these things, they're never going to be able to put the, toothpaste back in the tube, but are there people out there that are actively trying to think about ways to keep the men's tournament better, the men's side of basketball and college athletics better than what we are getting right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, I mean, I guess Purdue is probably as close as a team that's stayed together.
Yeah.
And basically a lot of it is because of, you know, probably Zach didn't see his draft position last year. I think he would have probably gone somewhere in the second round. I think the latest mock that we have up is that he's in the lottery.
Yep.
13, 14 probably could go even a little bit higher. I think for the product to get better, and it's kind of like I'm kind of contradicting myself, it's almost like the NIL money has to kind of continue to grow, that players are more incentivized to stay in school. Mm-hmm. I think maybe that changes with, you know, the G League Ignite no longer existing here. You know, it's almost like, you know, Gonzaga had a, you know, when Timmy was there, you know, they had a lot of guys that were there, you know, 2-3 years.
Yep.
You know, Kentucky is that, you know, it's funny. Kentucky might have 6 guys drafted in the first round and they lost in the first round. You know, I mean, that's the reality of it. Like the, what happened with them with, you know, Reed Shepard in play grade and Rob Dillingham, you know, those guys might go in the top 10. So I think, yeah, I mean, I think if the NIL money continues to grow, you might start seeing guys in school 2-3 years. And maybe we start getting those rivalries that we had back in the 80s, you know, when Houston and, you know, late 90s with, or early 90s with UNLV and Duke and those teams, you know, NC State is probably as kind of captivated everyone, but really just because they were the underdog, you know, mm-hmm. the underdog team that won 5 games in the ACC and have basically strung along 4 more wins here. But we might go into a Final Four weekend and, you know, we're going to be staring at UConn Purdue because both teams blew out their opponents.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. Also, NC State captivates us because we get a player that NFL teams are looking at, you know, they're scouting. They're like, hey, what are you doing after this? Because maybe you want to play D tackle for us. Like maybe you want to come to the NFL, DJ Burns. And that's the thing I still will always love about the college game and that will keep me attached to it is, to me, the NBA has gotten a little bit too uniform with the 3-point shooting. The games, a lot of them very similar, the way that teams try to design themselves. Everybody wants, you know, what Masai Ujiri was obsessed with for so long, which is a 6'9 guy who can play defense and shoot threes. And in college, you just still get the DJ Burns and the Edies, and they take over tournament games. Like, you watch Klingon, and it's like, yeah, this makes sense that a team has a big and that these guys can actually play in this league. And if it's not as uniform. Different teams do different things. But, yeah, I really do hope that you're right, that guys will stay. My hope is that they also, though, stay with the same program and there's less bouncing around. Like, there's the kid on Alabama, and they're like, he's played for 14 teams in 5 years. And I'm like, how am I supposed to care about this guy being at the program? He's the ultimate mercenary. You're telling me that it means a lot to him winning a championship with Alabama when it's his 14th team? Like, that's the key for me is I don't mind guys leaving. For the NBA, I hate it when it's guys who are transferring from multiple teams over multiple years. That's where it loses me and feels too professional.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a big reason why I think the NIT tournament is diluted a little bit here is because a lot of those teams, whether it be St. John's or St. Bonaventure, you know, teams that probably would have been in there, the transfer portal started that Monday after the selections was announced. And those teams felt like playing another 1 or 2 or maybe 4 games was at a disadvantage to them because the portal opened and they would have been behind the 8 ball as far as what they can go out and do and everything. And yeah, I mean, I think it's not as bad as probably where, you know, I think NCAA football is, you know, I think they've kind of mixed that up where you're basically having guys basically sitting out bowl games. I mean, can you imagine if guys would have said, you know what, I'm not going to play in the first round of it because I'm going to put my name in the transfer portal.
You just gave me a shiver. I mean, you just gave me a shiver down my spine because I know that's going to happen someday, and I had never even thought about it. It's definitely going to happen someday.
Yeah, I mean, so then fix it. Fix it. I mean, you could still have the rule, but maybe you put the, you know, if we ever got to the point, maybe have the portal after the last game of the finals, right?
Yeah.
Or the, you know, that Monday, maybe that Tuesday when everything is over and everything. So I don't think we're there where NFL is, but yeah, I mean, where college football is, but definitely you see, it's hard. The men's game is hard because we don't, you know, there's like, you're watching Duke and you're like, well, where was he last year? And
Yeah.
It's not like the old days where I'm like UNLV rolled out and you'd be like, yeah, I knew Greg Anthony and Stacey Augman and Larry Johnson. Those guys have been there. Those guys have been there 3 years.
I'd wonder what the NBA's thought is, though, in terms of the development, right? Because Adam Silver has talked about this, and I think that they were mostly referencing AAU, right, with the whole the rest of the world is catching up and looking around at all the international stars that lead the NBA and the constant conversations about, like, who's the best American-born player, right? But I do wonder how they think about the NCAA factoring into that pipeline, because now you mentioned it, the G League Ignite shut down. The Ignite were 2-32 before folding. Good stuff. Yeah. Real great project that worked there. This is a two-parter, but one is, what went so wrong with the Ignite? Because now in hindsight, it looks horrific, and everybody that doubted it is like, see, but no one was really paying attention to why it failed or how it failed. And then two is, yeah, do you think that Silver focuses on some of this stuff with college, that he actually does view it under his like purview when it comes to that development that he's afraid has been lacking for the NBA?
Well, I would just say this. When we get to the MVP voting, whenever, I guess it could probably come out sometime in May, mm-hmm. I mean, the commissioner is going to be staring out the top four players being international.
Yep.
I mean, so when you look at Jokic and Shea and Giannis and Luka, mm-hmm. those guys are going to be the top four. There's no question about it.
And who's going to win Rookie of the Year? Where.
Well, yeah, and Victor's going to win rookie of the year here, and maybe be on defensive. So if you're, and that's why I never understood like the whole, you know, when we were talking about the All-Star game, and everyone was like, oh, and I said like, hey, mate, we do USA World, and then maybe you rotate it every 4 years, and every year is a different theme. Everyone's like, well, there's not enough good international players. I'm like, what are you talking about? Jamal Murray hasn't made an All-Star team, and he would be on that team. Like, there's depth there. So I think the commissioner is going to be looking at that as far as, you know, how do we get, the depth of Americans is strong, but how do we kind of improve the product of, you know, from the college going to the NBA. And yeah, I mean, this year with the Ignite was a, you know, certainly a total failure with the roster. A lot of it, you know, but there has been success when you look at guys that have been drafted, whether it be Jalen Green or even, I mean, Scoot struggled this year, but there's been a list of guys that have gotten drafted. I mean, the Thompson twins have probably been the two best, but they were at overtime. So that's a little bit concerning, I would say. And then a lot of it's kind of the makeup of the roster. You know, I think they had a little bit too heavy of young players, not enough veterans. And then you go into the G League and you watch some of those guys. Like, that's a man's league. I mean, basically a bunch of 25-year-old 6'5" guys, you know, that are trying to break into the league. And you hit the perfect storm this year with that. And then you had, you know, the NIL money is, you know, has kind of really improved a lot, where it makes going to college for a first year more sense for these kids.
Yeah, I always hated the G League Ignite. I just didn't think it was going to work out because of that reason. I didn't want 18-year-old kids trying to go into a league where it's the 25-year-old six guys that are, the guys who don't care about their development at all. It's like, why do I care about you? I'm trying to make the NBA. But two is just simply, I think that physically, probably not overly ready, but the game is just, you're not being really coached. You're not playing what I think is even close to college basketball, from a buy-in standpoint, from a systems buy-in, from a teammate standpoint, like all of it. And I don't think it's a coincidence that, Jalen Green has taken this long to start looking like a competent NBA player. I don't think it's a coincidence that Scoot has come out and been horrific. Like, what was he the other night? Minus 52 or something like that?
Listen, Scoot struggled this year. I mean, you watch some of these, like at the end of some of the games, he's not on the court. And I think that's a big part of a development. And, you know, Jalen, since, you know, March has been all NBA, but listen, like people forget, like, it's funny. Like I almost say to people, like, did you not watch the first like 50 games in Houston where he was probably almost going to get benched?
Yeah. It was unplayable.
He was going, you know, he was averaging 18 points and shooting 31% from three. And the offense ranked in the bottom five in efficiency here. And he's been terrific. And that's great. And, you know, Ime Udoka had a good point. He's like, listen, these guys are so young. You just have to preach sometimes of patience here. And it's it's almost like that quarterback that gets drafted, right? Like mm-hmm. it's going to take by year three for hopefully them to figure out. And he's, I think he's figured it out, in Houston.
So I want to get into some of the draft stuff with you. And because you mentioned a couple of things already that I wanted to touch on. But one is Zach Edey, the Canadian kid. He went from last year, as you already mentioned, hey, maybe he's in the end of the second round, right? That was the book, and everyone went, okay. And he's this big, lumbering kid that we all thought was like from a bygone era. And my only thought about him really was, how can he help Canada, Team Canada, internationally? Because having the seven-footers means so much more in the international game. So, okay, develop him for that. Develop him for that. Now, like you mentioned, I looked at your guys' mock draft. I think he was sitting at 13. Either way, it was late lottery, somewhere in there. I look at the Ringers. They have the same kind of range, which is late lottery. How did this change so drastically? Because that's quite the departure from maybe he doesn't get drafted, even draft class aside, to late lottery pick.
You know, and it's in Donovan Klingon, who's in, at UConn, is, I think, three.
Yeah, people
right?
are like, I mean, he's going to be the first American off the board.
Yeah, that would be fascinating, those two against, you know, 2 7-footers against each other in the championship game here. I think centers matter more now. You know, we went away from this, and probably still in this little bit of era, like this positionless basketball where we need a bunch of 6'8" guys. I think having a low post presence, a guy that you can throw the ball to, that you can get easy baskets, that can block shots, can protect the rim, I think that matters a lot more than maybe it did 3 or 4 years ago. And yeah, maybe this year's draft class is certainly, it's been billed as one of the weakest in a long time. That, you know, probably helps him a little bit here. Maybe he would have been, you know, I don't know, late teens, 20s. I think he would have still probably been a first round prospect here. But another year of just overall development. I think their guards are better, or have gotten better here, where they made an effort in the Tennessee game just to basically dump the ball down low, right? Just like feed him the ball, get him to the free throw line, and I think that has certainly helped him.
Yeah, I maybe they changed some of the rules, like maybe because they want that defense, and people are looking at it going, all right, maybe if they change the three in the key rule, the Zach Edey can be a little bit more valuable. I just trying to picture him now in an NBA game for more than like 5 minutes feels still strange to me. You know, like I'm gonna have to get used to it. I'm gonna have to believe it, and maybe it'll work out when we see it. But yeah, it is odd that right now we've got two guys at the very top of the draft that are both traditional, you know, big old centers, right? Like big old dump the ball in centers. Okay, so with this draft, and you mentioned Klingon has clearly done well for himself in terms of rising, and Edey has done well for himself, and maybe that only gets even more solidified if they end up in a championship game playing each other. But do you think that this tournament has been, like, how has this tournament affected the way that front offices are viewing at least the collegiate players and this draft?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I mean, did Reed Sheppard or Rob Dillingham help themselves, the two Kentucky players? Probably not. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if they would have had a long run, it probably solidifies them probably in the top five. Now they're probably, in that 6 to 10 range if they both do come out. I think you have to be careful with, as far as evaluating players in a a 6-game tournament, right? Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of players that have played extremely well that weren't really on the radar get drafted in the first round, and then all of a sudden, like, they're out of the league 3 or 4 years later. So I do think there's got to be that body of work, but these are high-pressure games. Like, these are high-pressure games. Sometimes the moment is too big, and I think that is taken into consideration. I think it's going to be interesting, you know, the UConn players, whether it be, you know, they're going to likely probably get to a finals, you know, with Klingon and Stefan Castle, their freshman here, who could certainly rise up the ranks. That will help them. I mean, that's the reality of it. That will help those, you know, help Jordan Hawkins last year, who made a lot of big shots and then gets drafted in a lottery.
Yeah. With these guys though, too, everyone's basically compared this draft, like, or at least you keep hearing it over and over. It's the worst draft since the Giannis draft. It's the worst draft since the Giannis draft. And I'm like, okay. But so Giannis picks 15th in that draft.
Yeah.
What do you think the odds are that the best pick in this one falls outside the top 10?
Usually it always happens that way, except for probably Victor. You know, it's like, you know, even, you know, when Scotty got drafted, you know, you can make the argument that, you know, where he went, he could, if we redrafted, he would potentially go number one. So I think that's just usually the norm. I think what these drafts do, and I think a lot of it is separates really the good personnel departments. I think we get caught up in the names, whether it be Holmgren and, you know, Jabari Smith and Evan Mobley and last year with Victor and Scoot and Brandon Miller and stuff like that. But I do think there's probably depth in this draft. I think it's interesting that it's broken up into 2 days now. I think it's interesting that basically a third of a league is probably off the board, basically the ability to go out and buy picks. Mm-hmm. So that helps generally teams like Toronto if you want to get in the mix there. Although they do have a bunch of, you know, draft picks already, and the possibility of keeping their own is increasing increasing by the day right now here.
Very much so.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So I think, you know, I mean, the guy you pick at 10th 3 years from now might be the top pick, and maybe the best pick, you know, if we had to redraft it.
I'll tell you this, from a fan standpoint, from a non, like, draft guy, from a non-super college hoops guy, we've got the top of the draft with a bunch of international guys that I've never seen and never will see outside of YouTube clips, right? So it's like you got Topic and Sar, and I can't even see the French kids. Like, I don't know these guys, and I never will until they're here. So there's a bunch of guys like that. And then there's an Ignite kid who, again, I was like, oh, I guess. It's like, I've never seen you play. See you in the YouTube highlights, I guess. That's where I'll catch your game. But then every single one of the other lottery picks that are projected, I could not be less excited about if I was, well, I am a Raptors fan who is looking. It's like, you want the undersized Kentucky guards who choked, or do you want the massive big guys that have seemingly upped their stock, but don't look like you're not getting superstars here. Like the kid that I went, oh, I can kind of see how this was, like Jacoby Walter out of Baylor, where I was like, okay, I kind of see
that. Yeah, I mean, the kid out of Tennessee certainly helped. I mean, he had a really good year.
Connect.
Yeah.
But he's 25 years old.
That's fine. Yeah. Right. Like there, you know, eventually, and I think that does help teams. And I think that, you know, it's almost like you have to look, you have to kind of separate it. And this is where teams get in trouble. It's like, you have the player that's kind of the more proven player, a bit older, versus, you know, now, you know, we're looking for the next Giannis, right? We're looking for that 19-year-old that's going to take 3 years, and he's going to hopefully develop into an all-NBA type player. And that's, you know, that's where teams kind of get in trouble a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Before you go, I got one current NBA question for you. And that's, I'm fascinated by the Mavericks. And I said this actually a couple of weeks ago when they were in town. I went, there's no team that's more confusing to me from the standpoint of every time I look at their roster, I go, this should work better. If Luka's as great as he is, which he is, the team should feel more competitive, and they shouldn't feel as flawed. And now he's going and Kyrie's going and the pieces around them feel like they're working. I think they've ripped off 7 in a row. Do you think that they have unlocked something? Because they look so good that my brain is telling me if it's not, like if I had to pick the team that was actually going to beat Denver this year, I think I would pick them.
Yeah, you just hopefully they don't get Denver in the first round.
Yes, that'd be a nightmare. I would hate that for the NBA.
Yeah, listen, I said it the night of the trade deadline. I think I said it on TV when we were asking about the big winners, and I put Dallas up there, and I had a lot of people not laugh but say, well, they gave up 2 first round picks for PJ Washington and Daniel Gafford, and I just said, listen, when you have a player like Luka on the roster, you do everything possible to surround him with the best available talent here. And they've found a nice balancing act between Gafford at center and Derek Lively, who's probably going to make all rookies here with those two players. The availability matters. Kyrie on the court matters, right? A healthy Kyrie means the world of things as far as how good they are, as great as Luka's been this year. And what they've done is they've got a really nice boost from Derek Jones, who's, you know, they've kind of inserted at that power forward. They get to the rim, you know, it's basically kind of a layup line, you know, layups and dunks. That's kind of been, I think they probably ranked number one since the All-Star break here. Mm-hmm. And The Western Conference, man, is a bear. You know, it's like I'm writing these off-season articles, and I'm like kind of in a holding pattern because some of these, you know, the back end, you know, those 9, 10 teams, these 7, 8, like we could be looking at the standings a week from now, and all of a sudden Sacramento is in the 9-10 game because, you know, with the Malik Monk injury here. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I think if you're Dallas, you got to get the 5, you know, you got to get the 5 because you are going to, you know, you'll avoid, you know, if you're in a 6 seed, you might get Denver.
Yeah.
You know, you might get Minnesota, which I don't think you'd want. Like, you'd probably take a shot at OKC. But any of those top 3 teams are going to be pretty dangerous as far as OKC and Minnesota and Denver.
No, there's a lot of great teams, or like, sorry, very good teams in the West.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of very good teams in the West, and I feel like they're deep, and not a lot separates, you know, even if the Warriors got into a series with, like, you know, the Timberwolves, I'm not betting my life the T-Wolves win that series. You know what I mean? Like, so it's basically 1 through 10, a lot of even to me. But with Denver very much clearly at the top because the two-man game to close. But the difference with Dallas is they have the two-man game that I think can match Denver's in a tight ball game. Like, I could just see Luka Doncic stealing these games. I don't really see that from anybody else. Like, I don't think that the Thunder could beat them 4 times. I don't think that the T-Wolves could beat them 4 times. I thought maybe the Clippers could, and I know they've won a couple in a row now, but ultimately it's kind of fallen apart, and there's, like, a lot of really bad underlying numbers with them. There's also some eye test stuff with them, and then some possible behind the scenes drama with the Paul George stuff. But like, do you see anybody else beating Denver in 4 games today outside of Dallas? Like, how would you even stack it?
The only way I could see it is a healthy Minnesota team.
Okay.
You know, if Towns comes back, I don't think they can beat him without Towns. I think just because of the size here, but even Minnesota, like, how much does the ownership stuff become a distraction, right? Like, that's like, talk about timing as far as with selling the team. Now, not selling the team, it probably doesn't, because guys are probably more focused on the court here. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, a team that's not gotten out of the first round. But, you know, the stakes are different this year, where the expectation level is certainly a lot higher here. So Minnesota, you know, is certainly intriguing, I think, if Towns gets back healthy.
Yeah. Hey, Bobby, always appreciate the time. Thanks so much for sharing your insight with me.
You're welcome. Have a good day. Talk to you.
Take care. Bobby Marks, front office insider for ESPN. And, of course, former Nets assistant GM. I'll get excited closer to the draft, and once I watch the actual, I don't have time to watch, I don't even say it, Matas Buzelis tape, who is currently being projected by ESPN to go to the Raptors. So Matas, you might move me in ways that I wasn't expecting. But yeah, you played for a team that won no games, and it was on the G League Ignite, and you were so bad that the league went, we're going to shut it down. I don't think that's a great sign. That's not what you want to hear. And the fact that, okay, I really had this thought when I was thinking about these mock drafts and then also watching the UConn game is, I really genuinely thought, man, I hope Klingon falls to the Raps at 6. That could be a good pick. And I was like, what are you talking about? You want the big lumbering white guy center as your top 6 pick? When have you ever thought that in your life? You almost wept the night that they picked Jonas Valanciunas. You couldn't believe it. And this was someone, like, a different era. So I like that. That's a good reminder from Bobby, is that it's the center is kind of eking his way back. The rim protecting big, eking his way back. And if they keep going this direction with the way that they're calling fouls and the game is becoming a little bit more physical, they're trying to alter it so that the game feels as though the scoring is not too simple. Getting a guy like Zach Edey in a game for a few possessions, and if you're gonna get just a little bit more offensively than what you give up defensively, that's a win. You take it. How's a guy like Draymond gonna match up with him? Hey, all of a sudden too, I thought about this as well. I think maybe Wembanyama is so great at his size, that other executives too are looking at this draft and saying, maybe we need some Edies and some Klingons just to be able to roll out there for 12 minutes to give him a different look. Because how are we going to stop this guy when he gets better? Like, I know we got the preview of this kid when he came to Toronto and put up stats we'd never seen before from a rookie. He kicked the Raptors' teeth in and went, yeah, about that Scotty Barnes guy. I'm going to make you doubt everything that every hope that you had about Scotty Barnes because you're going to watch me up close and in person. But I think he's so great that he might end up changing the complexion of the league. And this draft might be where we start to see it. But yeah, I didn't watch enough Kentucky. I watched them because they only lasted one tournament game. I saw them twice all year. But the Raptors already have their undersized Kentucky guy that they have the upside from. That's done. I couldn't see it with the Cody Williams. I didn't see it. I know he's young. I know his brother is great. I think it's a mistake to say that just because his brother is a polished product that he is going to end up turning out that way. I don't think that the Raptors can take Grady Dick last year and then Dalton Connect as their top pick this year. Don't think that really works. It's going to be an interesting draft for them. The hope is, the reason why I asked Bobby, and I like what he said there too about this is the kind of draft where you really show off your development and your ability to identify, because now all of a sudden the Raptors have a lot of equity in this, right? Like, they're going to end up having 31. They're probably going to have a pick that's between 17 and 21, and then a pick that is likely number 6. So they'll have 3 picks in the first 21 this year. If this is the kind of Giannis draft, then you're hoping, I think, anyways, that you can, this is the ideal goal for the Raps, that you hit on a role player and maybe a starter. Out of those 3 picks, if you could end up with that, you're very, very happy with it. I just, everything I've watched and everything I keep reading, and I'm like, I'm not excited, which sucks. Because you'd like to have something to get a little bit more excited for, seeing as the basketball team here won't win any games at all, likely for the rest of the season. Maybe they got one left. Maybe they got one win left in the bag. All right, let's take a quick break. Let's hit what we missed. I don't like this song because it reminds me of the Toronto Blue Jays. And had you not listened to the start of the show, you would understand that it's like, had you listened, you'd know that I am not thrilled, okay? Yeah, it's 5 games in, but they scored all their runs against one of the worst pitchers I've ever seen. And I'm kind of in the mode of, take out the Alexander stats, and what do you have from the offense so far this season? By the way, Bobichet is what they are calling a cranky neck. I think it's fun to be folksy with injuries, unless it's the star player and you can't hit the baseball. Then I want to know exactly when he'll be back and what it is and whether or not you should be worried, okay? This isn't Mitch Marner ahead of the playoffs trying to downplay an injury or trying to be mysterious. This is like, hey, tell us where Bo is and when we'll see him hit. Because I don't know how many times I can watch that, what I saw yesterday. Actually, I know how many times I can watch that. One time. One whole time. Without losing my top. Ugh. The highlights are on the TV right now, too. It's haunting me. It won't escape me. Mike is playing the Jays basically theme song and they're running the highlights. Oh, another strikeout. Oh, what do you know?
Oh, they played at the ball game. That's why you're connecting the trophies with the Blue Jays, right?
Yeah.
It's like game ops, yeah.
They always play that. I think they have a commercial with it too or something. Got something else or an ad? No, because they do with the Blue Jays. I love that song though, actually. That song brings me a lot of joy. I don't want the Jays to ruin that for me, okay? Like, I love that song. When I hear that, I get excited. I love that. That's actually, I think that that's the best song outside of football, which all of them are the best. Like, every single one. You can go through it. It's a, whichever one tickles your fancy the most, but it's like NFL and Fox, CBS. It's all of it is incredible. ESPN, they do so well. NBC, they all do incredibly well with the theme songs. Then it's obviously NBA and TNT. And which is actually maybe even like number one. That's the best. Round Ball Rock is clearly the best. But I think I put the Jays one high, sneaky high. I just love it. It's just right away. It's like, get ready. Da, 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 da. I'm like, oh, I hear it. And I'm prepared. I'm prepared for them to get no hits. The offense will be different this year. We're doubling down. It better be. Anyway, I actually wanted to call Ben for 2 seconds. to ask you if tonight is a must win, if tonight is already game six is the second must win of the Jay season, because I'm telling you, it kind of feels that way. Like, they're playing Framber Valdez and Barrios is on the mound, and I think it's going to be a pitching duel, because I think the Barrios stuff is very, very, very real. Like, that he's going to be, like, I know people go, he's already good, he's been good. And it's, no, I'm telling you, I think that he's going to have a spectacular season and put himself, change his perception amongst this fan base a little bit. He's going to have more of a bump. But holy hell, do they need some, they cannot come home next week on Monday, limping in to the Rogers Center, multiple games under 500 with an uninspiring offense that only tacked on a bunch of runs against a slop tosser on the Rays, who looked, again, as bad as I've ever seen a pitcher. So you're going to say positive regression. Let's see it. Hey, Dalton Varsho, mix in a hit and don't bunt with runners on. Bo Bichette, uncranky your neck, okay? Give it some coffee. I don't know. Get a massage. Figure it out. Get back in there. Vladdy hit a heater. Turner hit a baseball against someone that isn't Alexander. What was the thing? Don Mattingly is like the offensive coordinator now. Oh, he's the offensive coordinator. Oh, they get the early inning game plan. Hey, we need a better game plan than the one from yesterday, because yesterday's game plan stunk. Okay, whatever you guys were planning, scrap it. Back to the drawing board. Anyways, what did we miss? That's enough Blue Jays. I gotta stop. It's a long season. I can't burn out. I cannot burn out. Okay, what's next?
5-0 Yankees coming up too.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, great. Juan Soto legitimately looks like the greatest player on earth. And yeah, no. Jays fans thought that they were going to get him for Ralphus Martinez. Oh, anyway.
Their first 5-0 start in 32 years as well for the Yanks. But let's move on to DJ Burns.
What about him?
Well, after his performance on Sunday night, Jokic was very complimentary of the big man, saying, I think he's so skilled, especially being a lefty. Seems like his teammates like to play with him. And, you know, Jokic doesn't usually get giddy over basketball talk, but he seemed that way.
Mm-hmm.
If you could catch a surprising compliment from anybody of your choosing, because it'd be pretty cool if your DJ Burns, the best player in the world, is complimenting you, who would it be for you?
Oh, unquestionably just industry people I respect the most. And there's too many to just, like, start ripping names. But one, I actually don't think we do a good enough job of it here. Like, praising the work of others, the elite work of others. It should be more prevalent, given that a lot of what we do in sports media is actually pretty difficult. And the ones who do that very well, like, you can be bad and be a part of it, but to be really good at it, and I'm talking about radio, television, writing, and now you kind of have to be able to do a ton of it, right? Like, you've got to be a cross-platform multimedia star. Like, it's incredible that, you know, Elliot Friedman jumps on national TV and is really great at it and, you know, can also write the way that he can write and then jumps on a podcast and dominates it. Like, that's unbelievable. I think that there are people who have areas of expertise, and so they benefit in some other places, and you go, okay, well, you know, you're really good at this, and so they put you on a couple of other things that you're not really great at. But even still, being great at something in this industry, to me, I think takes a lot of work. People look at it and say, well, you're just watching sports. How hard is that? Like, I still have people who think they have buddies who would be great at this. They'll be like, it's a high level, I could do that job. From outsider's perspective, from a lot of people think like, oh, I could do that. And you could get through a radio show. Like, time will pass. You would talk, the clock would move forward, time wouldn't stop. You know, it's not building a house. Like, you get, the house isn't eventually going to get built. In radio, the house will get built. Like, you'll have a show. Will it be a good show? I don't think so. I think it's very hard to do a lot of this work. And so the only people that I ever the only people I really ever care about that give me compliments are the people who do the same work that I do. Like, not just the podcast and radio, is the people who do great television, the people who do great content. Great content creators, when you catch a compliment from them, especially, I will say, it does mean more coming from people who are older than you. I think it always does, because they've seen more and they have more perspective. And again, I really think it's lacking here. I don't see it a lot. I think that there is still a famine mentality with sports, where people think that, like, there's not enough to go around, and they're afraid of losing positions, and they feel like if they speak on someone else in a positive way, that it's going to, you know, make the other person shine too much. I think, like, the way I could equate it is, and, you know, Mike, you're a big stand-up comedy guy. It used to be that a lot of big acts would bring crappier openers because they wanted to look good in comparison to the crappy opener. And now comics have realized, no, what you want to have is, like, basically headliners open for you so that you have an incredible show. And that's the way that content is always going to survive in places like this, is if you just have headliner after headliner. You don't want to be the only headliner. That sucks. You want to be with other people that you view are your peers. And part of that is that you actually want to elevate those people so that they're seen, and because you want to be a part of that. And so I've always taken the most from those that I think are very, very good at the job. And there's so many to list, but that's when it means the most. And I know that when as I age into this job, one of the things that I will always try to aim to do better than the generation before me is take note and take time to let other people know what you think of their work when it is special. Because a lot of it goes unseen, man. A lot of it goes unseen. Not everybody can do it. And time again, I see people come into the building that think they love it, but really they're just here because they think it's a bird course. Like, they think, oh, it's sports. It's pretty simple. I can get by on kind of watching some games and getting away with a little bit of this. It's like, okay, but to be truly great at something, you really have to be dedicated at it. You have to care about it. You have to be passionate about it. You've got to sacrifice a lot, and not a lot of people want to sacrifice. Like, not a lot of people want to give up free time or vacations or weekends or, you know, a lot of the fun stuff to be great at something. And so, yeah, I think that's it, is peers of mine, contemporaries of mine, people who do the job, content creators of all ilks that do it at a high level, because I really think that, like most things, game recognized game. Even if you don't like the person personally, you got to respect the craft. And I don't see any reason for not being more forward with that kind of praise. So that's all I care about. Like, I care obviously when the audience reaches out. Like, that's always extremely nice, because that's people you connect with. But I'm talking about, like, you know, meaningful praise. That's the only place I care about it. Like, there's nobody else.
Jumping off that point,
yeah.
DJ Burns is getting legitimate interest from NFL general managers. Imagine Hewitt to switch to football. I wanted to ask you, if you weren't doing this, if you don't do what you do, the JD Bunkus podcast, sport media, what would you turn into if you had to, like, next week, you got to sign up for something and get going?
OnlyFans? I don't know. I'm pretty useless.
Like, I don't know if that will make your living wage, brother.
I don't know, dude. I think I'd try to go into sales. Because I think that part of this job is you're naturally just selling yourself every single day. You're selling a segment, you're selling an idea, you're selling your personality. So I think I've got a lot of reps at that. I overspeak, though, and I talk on top of people, and I prattle on, so I might be a bad salesman. I'd be like, I'd have the sale. Like, I often have the question, and then I'm like, here's 5 more minutes of talking, and people are like, I hate this guy. I'm not buying your vacuum.
Closing the deal would be your
issue. Yeah, no, so I don't know, sales, I'm too old to go and try the law school route thing again, and now I'm like, My number one thought in the AI jobs now is, how are lawyers going to survive? Like, I don't understand how a lawyer is going to survive AI.
No, I don't know about that, because a lot of being a lawyer is like touching people's emotional heartstrings. So I don't know if AI.
I think you know too much about lawyers from watching Suits rather than what a lawyer actually yeah. is. But anyways, thank you for weighing in on that.
I think if there's like a jury, that's definitely part of it.
You're like, that's definitely part of it.
You got to convince them.
No, billable hours is a huge part of being a lawyer, and if there's going to be artificial intelligence that can scan all precedent within a second and be able to turn out all of the case law that you need, all the relevant case law that you need. It's a pretty big, pretty impactful thing on their issue. Anyway, I'm done. I thought I was going to be a lawyer my whole life, and that is not the case. That is done. Yeah, I think I would have to do sales. I really don't think there's anything else I could do. I'd love to be a consultant. That would be, like, I always want to know how I can become a consultant with sports media. That's, like, when is the tipping point to someone actually listening to me on this stuff? Because I actually know a lot about this business. But if someone would just pay, like, that's the easiest job of all time. You're like, hey, let me just tell you what I would do. And people are like, oh, here's money. That's the best job. Consultant. Anytime a person tells me they're a consultant, I actually look at them like they're Oppenheimer. I'm like, you're a genius. Like, I'm so enamored by you. How did you get this job? How did you get the consultant job? Because I think that's my actual dream. I don't think my dream is to have the most successful podcast in the country. I don't think my dream is to become respected by my peers. I think my dream is to be a consultant, and people call me and I say, here's the rate, and they don't bat an eye, and they go, yeah, tell us what to do. And then I tell them what to do.
That's sport media consultant. Nothing
else? Anything. Any consultant. You're dominating. I hope there's consultants listening to this right now, smiling and laughing at me like, don't talk about this, JD. We're getting the money back. It's like, oh, shut up about it. It's like, there's no greater, in my opinion, anyways, easier job. Again, you had to work to get there, to get to that position, so fine. But there's no easier job to paycheck ratio than consult. What do you think? Give me that. I've met with like talent advisors and media. It's like, I want that job. That's the job I most covet. Please let me be that.
Reminds me of being an inspector too, for some reason. It's a little along that ilk of like coming by.
Some
like,
horrible takes.
This
Mike,
is wrong.
You're
this
Mike.
Is wrong.
Turn the mic on Mike. That's Mike. Mike, it's Mike's up. An inspector, you have to have like the most expertise. You got to be able to look at something and identify if there's a problem. Like,
well,
so you want
to
be
consultants
like,
need to be some type of
no,
experts
just like
too.
This is how Boeing happens. Is like Armin's like, why do we need inspectors? Why do we need inspectors? Who even
no,
cares?
It would be a good job,
hey, just hey, go on the plane and look at take a flashlight on the plane and just take a little peek. Take a little peek. Ah, we don't need inspectors. Take off. Oh, why are all the planes crashing? Armin's like, ah.
I think I should, okay, never mind. I'm pivoting to food critic.
Food critic is totally different. But again, you got to have a real palate to be the great ones. I respect that. Anyways, what's next?
We only have 30
inspector.
Seconds left.
That's the most terrifying thing of all time. Building inspector is like, yeah, the building collapsed. What happened? Oh, well, we didn't think inspectors were valuable. We thought they were just like kind of taking their shots out here in the dark. They were like, ah, is that building good? Ah, it's fine.
I definitely
that'll probably be
that
fine. Don't call the inspector. Armin says we're good. Anyway, subscribe to this podcast. Leave 5 stars. We'll see you tomorrow with Jeff Merrick.